The world has been upended by a novel coronavirus, and all we want to do is to return to normal. But how can that happen, and when? Today on What's New, an expert on the resilience of societies talks about the long road back after enormous tragedies. Welcome back to What's New from the Northeastern University Library. I'm Dan Cohen, and today I'm recording the show from my home, not the library, as we have been off campus and sheltering in place for 3 weeks. Thanks to John Reed, our podcast librarian, and the producer and sound engineer for What's New, I've got a setup close to what I have in the studio, and a guest who will be joining me remotely from his home. I want to welcome back to the program Steve Flynn, who was on our very first show 3 years ago. Steve is the founding director of the Global Resilience Institute at Northeastern University, where he leads a major university-wide research initiative to inform and advance societal resilience in the face of growing human-made and naturally occurring turbulence. At Northeastern, he is also a professor of political science. Can't think of a better person to have on the program right now, so welcome, Steve Flynn.
Dan, I'm thrilled to be with you.
I'm so glad you could join us, and I hope you are doing all right and your family and everyone at the Global Resilience Institute. I know that we're going to get to a wonderful site that your institute has set up to help our audience think about the present and the future and what they can do, and we'll get to that later in the program. I just thought I'd ask you to start off about how you think about disasters. I mean, I think you think about disasters all the time, unlike most of us. So I assume that what is happening right now kind of activates all your senses and years of thinking about how we go through difficult times such as these. And I just thought I'd ask you, sort of as you scan our current situation with your expert radar, what are you looking for in terms of both pessimistic and optimistic signals about what the future might hold?
Well, the optimistic side, and that's actually the dominant one for me, is that this event, and this is about as cataclysmic of an event that we've witnessed in my lifetime, is going to end up with us being in a much more caring and compassionate society than pre the event. Because one thing we know about disasters is that they remind us why it's so important we're social beings. That is, our only way in which we're really successful at dealing with risk and hazard is when we come together. If we fail to do that, we put ourselves at far greater risk and far greater jeopardy. And so given the scale of risk, it's truly global. It's hitting every community and every hamlet and township across the United States. I believe this will bring out the best in us. But it's going to take some leadership and some work on the basic skills one needs to be able to withstand a disaster like this. And very importantly, to think about what coming back looks like and hopefully coming back as a bouncing forward into a better place, in a more resilient place where we're able to handle disruptions, even one of this magnitude, far better next time around.
What are some of those optimistic signals about our social nature and the way that we've been collaborating and cooperative so far?
I think we're seeing it in so many vignettes that are, you know, things that stories that we're sharing with each other. Just a simple one in our neighborhood on a couple of nights ago, one of our neighbors suggested everybody stand out on the porch with a candle and celebration and solidarity with the health workers on the front lines. And we all did it. And it was a enriching feeling. In my neighborhood, you know, we all say hi to each other, we move around and so forth up to a point, but that was a coming together. You see it in the way in which young people are organizing ways to provide groceries and meals for older people who really shouldn't be leaving their homes to go into public spaces, and developing through social media tools ways to connect and organize these efforts. It's a very unusual disaster in that we've been told to essentially stay home. But we have powerful tools now that allow us to connect with one another, to innovate, even when we are away from one another. And we're starting to see that. And just as we saw after Katrina, with the hurricane that hit New Orleans, the evolution of the Cajun Navy, that basically people just got in their boats and went in and helped people who were in distress and flooded areas, and how that has continued through other hurricanes. when we're under stress, we come together often. But it's very important that we identify these instances and we celebrate them and we scale them. And the news is dominant largely with the story of the painful, the trauma that we're dealing with and the challenges that government and the medical community is dealing with. But the rest of us are coping, and some of us better than others. The ones who are able to cope better to be looking out for how to help one another. And there are practical ways for us to do that. It is happening around us in very creative ways.
It's great to hear all those very optimistic events and just what is emerging, as you noted. I did note, though, that one of the big elements of your work and the work of the Global Resilience Institute is that preparedness seems particularly important with respect to disasters. I remember you talking to me on the very first episode of this podcast when we had you on about the importance, for instance, of moving critical infrastructure to the right locations. And I guess one of the pessimistic aspects of what's happened early in 2020 is that the preparedness didn't seem as good as it should have been. And that's been very disturbing. Are you seeing ways that we can kind of make up for lost time in terms of preparing and planning what we can do, at least for right now, for the summer, for the fall and beyond?
On one level, we were woefully unprepared on the basics that have been well documented by any of us who've been looking at pandemic issues. I've been working and writing about this for many years. The basic block and tackling of how you deal with a disease outbreak that's virulent, that basically could kill us, requires that you have tests that are available, laboratories to carry out those tests, lab workers to work in those laboratories, a classic public health effort of going out and contact tracing. Your public health service has to be trained and able to do that, to ideally isolate and slow the infection rate so that you can contain the effort. You have to have adequate equipment for protective equipment for those workers who are on the front lines, and not just in the hospital, but the police and the fire and the EMS and all the players, the public health folks who are out in the street, the people who are going into homes of elderly, home health workers. We know that. We know you need surge capacity, that our medical capabilities in hospitals generally are pretty much full most of the time. So you have to have plans for, okay, if we had a lot more sick people, how would we house them? And some of the creative things we're seeing starting to happen, converting dormitories into place for sometimes health workers, but even patients, converting convention centers into new hospitals, these kinds of things we all understood needed to happen and should have been happening, and it did not. And very, very painful now to see the price that's being paid, and that we really are not going to be successful at containing the spread of this in any meaningful way. All we can do is slow it by time. Also very limited in terms of, the exposure, because we're running out of stockpile supplies and so forth. So unnecessary loss of death, unnecessary exposure to people in the front lines. That's a very sad story. It is where we are. There's not much we can do to fix it. Where we are looking ahead, though, this is not something that works like other disasters, where the ground moves in a major earthquake, maybe a few tremors afterwards, but it's done. Now it's clear the debris and rebuild. A hurricane comes, brings storm surge on shore, the sea recedes. Again, you clean up the mess from the wind damage and the whatever, and you rebuild. In this instance, we're almost certainly dealing with essentially an unfolding pandemic that will ebb and flow until we have a vaccine, a period of likely to be 18 months. And so we have to adapt to it. And that's where looking to the summer, looking beyond, is so important. Right now, we're in a state, the easiest part of sorts, painful as it is, but it's the easiest from the standpoint of a response, is to do what we're doing, which is to stay at home orders, essentially throw a kill switch in order to slow things down to reduce risk. But that can't be happening forever. So somehow we have to think through what's safe integration restart look like? What does it look like to open up restaurants? What do we do about still the vulnerable populations that still should probably not be at risk in public spaces versus those who may be healthy? What about employees? How are they going to feel comfortable coming back to a workplace? And retail, what about customers? How are they going to? All this requires planning right now to think through in this new normal, wherever it's going to be. And then we're going to have spikes of hotspots and so forth. So how do we deal with that? Maybe with hopefully a little more surgically than we're having to do right now. These are things that there's actually a lot of longstanding public health information about how you deal with contagious disease can be brought to bear. this virus is unique. It's a novel coronavirus, but nonetheless, many of these best practices are there. But we have to adapt, and that's something we should be working on. And if we're going to be successful at not just riding through the medical emergency, but coming back better and stronger as a society after this pandemic gets under control.
Can you take us a little bit behind the scenes about what is happening actually with respect to governmental and non-governmental organizations? What kind of approaches do they take at this point where they're triaging and, as you noted, starting to plan ahead, think about these questions of getting back to work, ongoing concerns, flare-ups? What is happening at those levels that might give our audience some reassurance?
I wish I could say I could reassure them on this. Very little.
Okay.
And here's what's happening. But I think there is something of a positive thing we could draw from it. Government at every level, our local government, our state governments, our federal government, will be overwhelmed to the breaking point responding to the medical emergency of this outbreak, of dealing essentially with the sickest of the sick, organizing the effort of trying to provide the means to the frontline health workers to work through this without having the healthcare system fail. That will consume all of their attention. It'd be almost impossible to find any more capacity in government beyond that, again, at all levels. So, okay, well, that sounds pretty grim. Only if we fail to recognize what is actually the greatest strength of our society, which is civil society. We actually have enormous capacity in our society. It's currently largely sitting idle. 80%+ of us are sitting home, thinking that, well, it's the job of the government and the government of doctors and nurses to make us safe. Well, that's true, that we can't really do much about that piece. We can't do a whole lot on the ventilators, and though people are doing remarkable things like making masks and so forth as a way to deal with this, you know, again, ingenuity is coming out, people wanting to help is coming out. But there is all this other need of our vulnerable population that need care, that need context. Elderly people are shut in, that need people to reach out to them and let them know they're okay, or find out if they're not okay, how they can help. Companies got to be vested in their communities. If the communities don't bounce back, companies are not very profitable. There is a lot of capacity within companies to be able to work with their employees, or as a university like Northeastern, where we've reached out and provide resources to not just our own community, but to the broader community. And so if all of us recognize there is a role that we can do and there's safe ways that we can do it, there is a lot of capacity can be brought to bear. But if we're looking to government at all levels, we have to realize they rightfully are consumed to the breaking point on dealing with the public health emergency. All the other cascading consequences of shutting down our society effectively here, shutting down our economy, all the things that are defined as non-priorities, that's going to have to be picked up by those of us who can. And that's where I say my optimism will come out of this as a more caring and compassionate society, precisely because we'll figure that out. We got to work together. But it does take, again, leadership. We have to show what those best practices are, how they can be done safely, even during an outbreak, and provide examples and inspiration for how we can step up and make sure the most vulnerable amongst us have a safety net of sorts, and how we can plan for and come back. It's not going to happen because the CDC is going to tell us, the Center for Disease Control is going to tell us, this is what you can do to go back to a restaurant. To some extent, it's going to be a conversation with restaurant owners and their community, their customers, to say, how do we do this? And again, I already see that happening. Even with my going out here, you have stores who are stepping up and taking responsibility and helping their customers understand what they need to do to be safe in their stores. And the more we do of that, the more capacity, less pressure we put on government itself so we can deliver the emergent care.
It sounds to me like the better parallels are not, say, a 9/11 or Hurricane Katrina, but something like a world war or a really long-lasting, devastating tragedy, but one that really requires everyone throughout society to sort of take on a role and roll up their sleeves and work together.
That's exactly right. We look back on that Second World War generation. We call it the greatest generation. And its greatness was, I think for most of us, we maybe look at it somewhat romantically, but it still was the society came together. And it mobilized at all levels to respond to a global emergency. Now, there was fighting a war against fascism. In this instance, it is a war that's even more daunting in lots of ways, which is against this novel coronavirus. But it will take all hands. It will take all it. So this was and is much more of a Pearl Harbor moment than a 9/11 moment. And with Pearl Harbor, our government had to focus on mobilization and war, and people had to make sacrifice. But they also pulled together from the Victory Gardens to the Rosie the Riveters to all those stories we know of that Second World War generation, the strength of which civil society essentially renewed itself and strengthened itself after the Great Depression came because of that common sense of purpose. And that's here too. But right now, we don't have leaders at the national or state level calling on us to help. In part, again, they're consumed with the crisis. But we can play a role by identifying amongst ourselves where we have capability. Look around us. There are a lot of vulnerable people now who've lost their jobs, elderly people who are in need, who don't have access to social services and resources because, again, the strains that are there. So lots of opportunities for us to be good neighbors, for companies to be good citizens and helping their and coming up with innovative, creative ways to get us through this challenging time in our lifetime.
Mm. What are some of the early signs that you're looking for to notice that we're actually on the first steps to recovery, the road to back to normalcy, as you've noted? I mean, it's going to take some time, and it sounds like it will certainly require a vaccine to be developed. But what are you looking for in terms of civil society and on the national level for some of those baby steps?
A very important thing that's actually starting to happen right here in New England, is leading the nation in this way, is actually a formal process to plan for economic recovery. This is being led by FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency. But Region 1, which covers the six states in New England, is mobilizing for the first time, planning for recovery. At the same time, a good portion of the emergency management community is focusing on the response. And we at Northeastern are helping that process at the Global Resilience Research Institute, knowing that we will come to that day when we'll see an apex in the contagion. We'll start to be able to come out of our doors. We'll start to be able to reopen up, but we have to have plans for that. And there are needs right now that are going unmet that if we can identify them early, hopefully we can get in and provide a backstop so that we can recover more nimbly from that. So there's a formal effort to essentially create a working group that involves the state at the leadership role, involves an effort to go into communities and find out what these needs are so that federal aid and assistance can ideally be prioritized to go where we'll do the most good, where the need is greatest. That kind of organization is key. It's only started right now in New England. Our hope is certainly it will spread out across the country. But the need to plan for and organize, and in this case, which is very important, the leadership for actually carrying this out is from not the Office of Emergency Management, or in Maine's case, or Massachusetts' case rather, the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency. They're focused on, rightly, the emergency of dealing with the COVID outbreak and the medical public health emergency. But it's the Office of Economic Development of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that's taken a lead on disaster recovery. And doesn't it make sense? The people actually do economic development should be in on the, okay, we have resources in need. How do we build back better and smarter? So they're part of the government that traditionally isn't, you don't think about as a part of a disaster response. We think about firefighters and police and medical people there. But those folks need to be mobilized and are being to plan for what does it look, and ideally it's a more resilient future as well. We're going to have to invest a lot of resources to building our economy back. Well, let's invest in things we need, like broadband out in the western part of the state, where we know we're seeing its frailty right now. Schools moving to internet, but we have some communities that really don't have broadband access at near the capability. So let's, if we got to do public works in part to get jobs going, let's plan for that. And let's address needs that are longstanding, too long neglected, and then focus in those areas. But that takes planning. And all that planning can happen by a lot of idle professionals right now toward getting us into that better place.
Mm. I was wondering about that, about the sort of lessons and the really significant transformations that will happen, say, in 2022 and beyond, are there things that you can clearly see like that? And certainly I was thinking municipal broadband, given all of this teaching from home and the importance of public schools continuing to carry on their mission. What other sort of big lessons do you think are there from this virus and what has happened that will change our approach in the future?
Well, I think that is a very important one. Again, we have inequities in that. In many rural parts of the United States, there really isn't good broadband access. And it's going to be like in the Great Depression. Many folks in the 1930s did not have access to electricity. The economics weren't there. It took the rural electrification during the Great Depression as a way to get essentially electricity to every household. So that same leadership and investment needs to be made, and this is the perfect time to make it. Again, it also is to be resilient. If we have to shelter in place again because we have another wave of the pandemic, we'll be better prepared, right, to be able to deal with that because we can do remote working and education in an equitable way across the society. So that's one sort of very straightforward. Another area I think we're really going to find, we have underinvested in municipal services and government services at all level. You know, there's been an anti-government thing going for a long time, but boy, if people are getting a wake-up call about what happens when your civil servants aren't there, aren't working, aren't well-respected, aren't well-resourced, they're paying a price. Competent government matters. It's how you get good public health. It's how you get effective planning. It's how you're able to mobilize an emergency like this. And hopefully it will be much more of a willingness for people to be less selfish and more willing to invest in the needs for providing. The social safety net is going to be shown to be woefully inadequate for so many vulnerable populations. So that hopefully will garner some attention. Very practically, I'm hopeful, and this is clearly a need, is that we do invest in critical infrastructure, in public works. You know, we have a woeful supply backlog of aging infrastructure that's created traffic jams when we were moving, that is wasting people's lives in cars, is adding to pollution, aging power grid, aging water, wastewater. All this needs investment. We were talking about it sort of before this, but now people need jobs. It's almost certain the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston recently said that a projection they're looking at right now is the commercial construction in New England may essentially not be in place for 5 years.
Wow.
There's no need to rebuild when already we are sort of overbuilt if the economy shrinks. Well, those are top middle class blue collar jobs and trades that have no job. And so, but they could have a job. And it's great that they put up a new skyscraper in the Boston skyline. But how will we put them to work building, repairing bridges? How will we put them to work rebuilding roads? And how will we put them to work on new microgrids, new solarization, sustainable? And why don't we use rooftops that we have in urban areas to collect that power and create microgrids for it? There's a whole ability to reimagine. Every disaster creates somewhat opportunity. I often somewhat say in a almost flip way, disasters are a terrible thing to waste. And what I mean by that, disasters always command our attention, but they also usually command resources and they force us to innovate, or should. And this is an instance, though, where we'll need to do that on a much bigger level than we had in the past.
That's a great, you know, upbeat long-term message, I think. And there really are, I really think here in the Boston area, tremendous needs for infrastructure to be completely rebuilt. A lot of what we're operating on was built in the late 19th century. And so you can really see the shift in the resources in that direction paying huge dividends in the present and the future. I wanted to talk a little bit about the present and the future, just to end the podcast. Your team at the Global Resilience Institute has a tremendous resource for everyone who's listening and what they can expect in these coming weeks and months, a site called COVID-19, How to Be Safe and Resilient. We will link to it from the show notes at whatsnewpodcast.org. But maybe you could tell our audience for a little bit about the site and how it can be helpful to them.
We were animated to put this site together because we knew how important it was to try to help people feel empowered with the knowledge they need to make themselves feel safe, to make their household feel safe, if they were going to feel able and willing to be able to engage with their neighborhood and the broader community. So very basic need. How does an individual really not catch this virus? We do things like washing our hands. Well, how do I do that? We don't want to touch our face with our hands because that might be a conduit if it goes to our nose, ear, or eyes. Well, it turns out a lot of us do that all the time. So how do we break some of those habits? if the virus can get into our house, how do we disinfect, which is different from cleaning? You actually have to clean a surface, then we disinfect it with a disinfectant. We have to let that sit for 5 to 7 seconds so the chemicals in the disinfectant will actually kill the virus. Oh, I didn't necessarily know that. So that's a helpful thing to know. How about if somebody in my home was sick and I need to provide care for them, but I also have somebody who's older, an older relative in here who I don't want to be exposed? How do I manage that? And there are people in my neighborhood who have needs. How do I go out and help them, elderly neighbors or those with chronic illnesses? How do I provide them support safely? And if I have to go into a grocery store or go into a pharmacy, how do I do that safely and get back home? So these are very practical measures to take, and that's what we outlined there. But we finish with two things. One is, how do you take care of yourself from a well-being and looking out for our mental care? That's very important. We're all under so much stress. And then how do I be a good citizen, basically? How do I be a COVID-19 leader in my neighborhood and help those who are in need?
Yes.
Our hope going forward is that we will actually increasingly provide information for when we are need to get back up and running. When we leave our homes, we're going back into a restaurant, we're going back into a retail. How do we do that safely? How do our employees feel safe in those settings? We also want to provide, importantly, stories about how we're coping, how we are resilient, identifying those stories and celebrating the creativity, the innovation, how people are looking out for one another, how they're adapting to this risk. So people can go, oh, I could do that. In most instances, it could. So they could be scaled, they'll be inspired and motivated. So it's a great resource. I'm so fortunate to be at a university that was willing to invest and take the effort to play this role for not just our own community, but for the wider community. And this is a free resource available to any company, any organization, and for any household to take advantage of. The U.S. Coast Guard, in fact, Commandant just pushed it out to all 45,000 men and women of the Coast Guard and their families as a resource. So it's something we're very proud of. We hope people will find very useful and will be a resource that will allow people not, again, feel just safe, but feel empowered to be able to deal with the risks that we're facing in ways that they continue to get on with their lives.
Well, I personally found it really useful, and I pass it along to my family and others. And I also look forward to going back to a restaurant at some point. So I will be sure to read about how I might be able to do that in the future. We will link to that from the show notes. Dr. Stephen Flynn is the founding director of the Global Resilience Institute and a professor of political science at Northeastern University. Steve, I look forward to seeing you back on campus, I hope in the near future. Thanks so much for joining us on the program today and helping our audience think through what's to come.
Well, thank you, Dan. I look forward to seeing you both at campus and also at that restaurant as we get back to that new normal. Thanks so much.
What's New comes to you from the Northeastern University Library, produced by John Reed and me, Dan Cohen. If you like this episode, you can go back through our catalog of shows on a wide variety of topics. Sample what you like at whatsnewpodcast.org. You can subscribe to What's New in your favorite podcast app. And starting with this episode, on the new educational podcast app, Lyceum, at lyceum.fm. Stay safe and be well, everyone. Take care.